Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as issues that could impact the Brock community and the community at large. On today's show, we talked to a Brock graduate student who won a prestigious award in August for his research focusing on the properties of a particular fungus. We hear from a Brock doctoral student in the Department of Psychology whose research studies the link between non-suicidal self-injury and suicidal behavior. In the War of 1812 commemorations rage on, we talk to the head of Special Collections and Archives at Brock about a new exhibit on St. Catherine's involvement with the war effort. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. It's not often we get to celebrate a fungus, one that does a fair amount of good, as a matter of fact, other than mushrooms, of course. But Brock graduate student Scott Behe has plenty of reasons to celebrate. Behe won a prestigious student award in August from the Society of Invertebrate Pathology, something no Canadian student has ever done before. This follows having his research published in Science, one of the world's top scientific publications. So what's all the hoopla about? Well, Behe and his colleagues conducted research focusing on the properties of Metarhizium, a widespread soil-borne fungus that just loves insects. But more than that, Metarhizium robs insects of valuable nitrogen. It then transfers it to the plants, acting essentially like a natural fertilizer. Scott joined us in the CFBU-FM studios earlier this week to discuss his fungus research, and I asked him how a nice guy like him got involved with fungus research in the first place.
It just came out of what I wanted to do in my fourth year project. So at Brock University, to get an honors degree in science, you used to have to do an honors thesis project. So you found a supervisor, did like a mini research project, and got your degree, and you went on to do whatever it is you wanted to do. And I hooked up with Dr. Michael Badochka, and he gave me a fourth year project that was interesting, engaging, and looked like it was going places. So when he offered for me to do graduate school, I stuck around because it was really interesting work, and there's a lot of new research, exciting research coming out of the project. So,
and while this may seem obvious, but was that something you were planning to do anyway, the graduate work? Or was it not until he gave you this project that you thought, well, okay, maybe I can do that?
I had thought about it a little bit, but my original plan was actually to go to medical school. And this opportunity presented itself, and like I say, it was such an interesting, engaging project, and it looked like it could really go somewhere. So when he did present the opportunity, I took the chance to continue on this way and go for a PhD instead of anything else.
Well, it's very nice. It looks good on your job resume when
yes.
You get a PhD. So before we get into the details of your research, what was your area of study while at Brock then?
I was a major in biological sciences. At Brock, when you do your degree in biological science, you cover everything from ecology to molecular genetics to evolution. You do all of that. So I didn't have a specific area of study. It was just a biological sciences undergraduate degree.
So what got you into that field of study?
I was really interested in kind of going to medical school. So I thought that this would be kind of a good route to do that with. And it is. We have friends who have gone through Brock Biological Sciences and have gone on to medical school. But during the undergrad, what kind of got me thinking a little bit about graduate school was the genetics. I really, really liked genetics. I thought that was really interesting. So that kind of opened my eyes a little bit to maybe some other opportunities.
So this may be a little difficult to answer since you were looking at medical school originally. What do you see yourself doing once you're completed at Brock?
Well, I'm not sure. I'd like to continue research, I think. There's options to do what they call postdoctoral fellowships. So when you graduate with a PhD, you get more or less a position at another university for about 2 years and you do research. Usually it's related to what you've been doing. You go to different labs in different areas of the world, sometimes far away, sometimes close, and just continue on the research path. And eventually, I suppose I'd really like to get into a university setting and teach or move over to private industry. I'm not too sure. Those are kind of the major two options, but I definitely like to continue on with research.
Now, you must have been pleased with the recognition from the Society of Invertebrate Pathology. How did you find out about the award?
Well, we were going to a conference in Pittsburgh. That was in August, and that was put on by the Society of Invertebrate Pathology. So I applied for what they call a travel award, where you put in an application, you put in a CV, a little cover letter, this kind of stuff, and they give certain people what they call a travel award. So they essentially pay for you to go to the conference. So I applied just to see, and they sent me an email back saying, you've won this. It's called the Mauro E. Martignoni Award. And I didn't really even know what that was at the time because I haven't been too involved. I'm still kind of young in this, so I haven't really been involved with the Society for Invertebrate Pathology. And then we looked into it a little bit more, found out it was a reasonably big deal. So when we were actually at the conference, they gave me a plaque and brought me on stage. And it was a little embarrassing, but very, very nice. And I was definitely pleased to win the award. There's a lot of great researchers in this area, so it was really nice to get the recognition for sure.
And that came after the research being published in Science.
Yes.
So it's been a great summer for you.
Well, the Science paper came out in 2012, so that was a year before. But since then, we've had, me and Dr. Brodochka have had together three other papers that we've published. So we've been pretty productive as far as our kind of research and publishing goes, and it's been a good couple of years.
What's it like to open up a publication like Science and you see an article and you're attached to it? You know that that's because of you and your work. It must be a great feeling.
It's very intimidating. It's a little scary, but it is definitely a great feeling. Something that we've done in this journal that's global, very prestigious. It was definitely wonderful, but it's scary. Especially for me, it was my first publication, so I'd never gone through this process before, and all of a sudden my research is in this journal, and it was scary. Great, but scary.
But you could probably get used to it.
I think I could, yeah.
Now, other than the award that you received in August, has there been any other recognition of your work since the Science article came out?
Just the other publications that we've had that have come out. We've had a couple of journals invite us to write papers, so that's a great thing. But no, that's about it. I mean, with that paper, and then like this award was the biggest kind of recognition other than that paper that I've got.
Now, you and your colleagues conducted the research on the properties of metarhesium.
Yep.
Got to learn that. How much was known about metarhesium before your research was being done?
Well, actually, lots and lots and lots was known about it, but from a different perspective. So it's an insect pathogenic fungus, and it's a very successful insect pathogen. And it's used as biocontrol agents. It's mass manufactured to apply into agricultural systems to kill off a number of insect pests. So there's been a lot of work done on this fungus from that point of view. But recently in our lab, so I think it was right around the time that I kind of started my fourth year project, my colleagues discovered that this was also a plant associating fungus. So from that perspective, very little was known about it. It was very exciting from a research perspective because it gave very interesting questions. Why would you have this insect pathogen fungus who's really good at it, who also likes to associate with plants? What's happening there? And that's where that kind of research was born. So if we look at it as kind of a two-sphered system, we have the insect pathogen in one sphere and the plant associating aspect in another sphere. In that sphere, very little was known.
Now, was it used in any agricultural form before your discovery?
Yes, but just as the biological control agent to kill insect pests.
Explain to me how that works, because when I was doing my research, I couldn't quite grasp how it would infect, if you will, the insect and do what it does.
Well, it's just has all these capabilities to kill insects. So when they apply these to agricultural fields, they actually apply a number of fungal spores. And then the spores, essentially, they live in the soil. And when you have an insect that comes along, if the fungus is able to adhere to the insect, it's then actually able to release a number of different enzymes and things that break down the outer cuticle of the insect. That actually grows inside the insect and proliferates and proliferates and proliferates till, of course, the insect is dead. There's no nutrients left in the insect. There's nothing left of the insect. And then it just spores again, releases more spores, and the cycle continues.
So it's not naturally occurring in the soil.
Yes,
you have to add it.
It is naturally occurring. It's actually one of the really interesting things about this is that it's very ubiquitous in soil. There's a number of different metarhizium species, and it's everywhere. It's just to add more to an agricultural system will just increase its ability to kill the insects. But it is found all over the world. There's a number of different species of metarhizium, and different species have been isolated everywhere from Arctic to the tropics to temperate regions to pretty much Eastern Europe, Western Europe, African nations, China. It's everywhere.
So really, there's no escaping it.
Not really.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. When I was doing my reading on this, I saw a picture of a cockroach, which is not a pleasant sight to begin
right.
with. And I don't think anyone is going to lament the passing of a cockroach. But man, that looked awful.
Yeah.
Like they showed the picture of it with the fungus having done its work. Yeah. And it was dead at that point. It's like, wow, what a messy way to go.
It can't be nice for the insect, but it's very efficient for the fungus.
Could it be used as a natural form of fertilizer, or would you have to add it to a fertilizer?
More than likely, in a number of systems now, it's already working in this capacity, just in its kind of natural sense. But we don't know very much about it from that plant associating perspective. But the hope is, or like the idea is, that much further down the line, of course, there's a lot of research that needs to be done before we get there, would be that an application of this fungus in some form or another to an agricultural field could protect plants from insects and then act as a fertilizer, as it's able to transfer that nitrogen to the plant root. So it has this kind of dual system to it. So
would there be any other real world applications for it other than controlling insects?
There's potentially a large number of applications. So this fungus is what's known as a plant endophyte in the way that it associates with the plant root. That's just a certain class of plant associating fungus. It's called an endophyte. And there is a number of other endophytes that have been a little more researched. They help plants survive in environmentally damaged soils, when there's lots of heavy metals in the soils. That may be a property of this fungus as well. We just don't know yet. So there could be a lot of different applications for this fungus as far as different areas of the system, but the applications, of course, would all be plant-related, of course.
So presumably there's no harm or damage to the soil
No.
with it being there.
No.
It's good for the soil.
It's fine for the soil. It's, like I say, like it exists in soils all over the world. It's just a natural part of soil systems everywhere, so it being in the soil is no harm to the soil or any other part of the ecosystem.
Now, what about soils that aren't as nutrient-rich as others? Like, there are countries, for example, where the soil is very arid. Presumably, there would not be a lot of nutrients in the soil to begin with, this, I suspect, being one of them. So you would add it to that.
You could add it to that system, yes. And then as long as, you know, there was insects around, which there always is, you could increase the viability of the plants in those systems.
This is quite a feather in the cap of Brock University. What can all the interest in your research result for you, do you think?
It's really good for me in the sense that I'm able to get more publications out there. To have this kind of publication is, like you say, a feather in the cap. So when I finish, I'll be looking to do a postdoctoral fellowship. So when I apply for funding and granting, it allows me to be competitive. Whether or not, I mean, there's no guarantees that just because you have this kind of thing, you'll get money, but it allows me to be competitive for a number of different, say, scholarships or funding opportunities.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't hurt.
That's exactly it. I mean, there's going to be people out there with more publications, maybe some with less, but it just allows me to stay competitive within the funding agencies.
Will you be doing other research on other projects?
At Brock, as I finish up, my research is centered around this. We wanted to test if other species of Metarhizium did this. Plus, there's other plant-associating and insect-pathogenic fungus that have recently been discovered. We wanted to test if they had the similar capability to Metarhizium. And we're testing kind of the capabilities of the nutrient transfer now, as far as what the plant's giving the fungus back. Maybe it's giving the fungus things when the fungus is giving, you know? So we're testing all of that now, and I'm doing some genetic work as well to try to see if we can't figure out exactly what is happening on a genetic level. So we know that it's transferring nitrogen. What form of nitrogen? How is it being transferred? So while there's lots left for me to do still, it is all centered around this main project of nutrient transfer.
So you could look into perhaps changing the genetics to make things more efficient in this regard?
That could be something that was done absolutely further down the line. So the first step, of course, is to figure out what exactly is happening, and then later on down the line, if this was something, which we think it is, that could be highly applicable, you could kind of optimize this fungus's performance by enhancing its genetics in those specific areas.
It's funny how a career path or a student's career path changes mid-course from medical school to this. I presume maybe a few years ago you never would have imagined in your wildest dreams this is where you would end up right about now.
Probably not. When I first started, at least in my undergrad, this definitely wasn't even a real option, but it's definitely worked out for the best. I'm very happy with what I'm doing. I have a great research group, a great supervisor. It's a really good place for me to be. Not to mention that it turns out when I bleed a lot or I see a lot of blood, I almost pass out. So medical school probably wouldn't have been the best option anyway. But regardless of that, I think that this is definitely the place that I should be right now. I'm quite happy with where we are.
That would be an occupational hazard.
Yeah.
I have heard of that, where people in the medical profession, they have a fear of blood and they will pass out when they're faced with blood. Not a good sign. fine.
It's only happened to me once, but it wasn't pleasant.
What happened?
I cut myself on a knife as I was just cleaning a knife. And, you know, I've cut myself before, not a big deal. And it was in the water and there was a lot of blood coming out. And I had to go sit down in the washroom. I felt like I was being nauseous and I was bleach white. And then it all passed, of course, and everything was okay. But it wasn't a pleasant 20 minutes.
So you didn't know this beforehand?
No, I've cut myself before. I've seen blood before. This was the first time that it happened to me.
Was it just the volume of the blood?
It may have been. I'm not sure.
Wow. Somewhere there's a cockroach that's saying, see, you know, I'm not the only one that's suffering, buddy.
Yeah. But on the plus side, I'm in a great place that I like to be in. The opportunities are great. Like I say, we have a great research team. It's definitely a much better option for me regardless. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the research team. How large was the team on this project that you were working on?
There's only a few of us. Our research group is fairly small. At the time on this project, there was myself, Dr. Michael Badochka, and Dr. Paul Zalisco, who is in the chemistry department at Brock University. And that was about it. It was just the three of us who did this work. There was other people in the lab, of course, but they were working on their own projects, doing their own thing. So
this is fascinating, and it's wonderful to have you in today to talk about it. I thank you very much, Scott. Best of luck with your research in the future, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
That was Brock graduate student Scott Behe talking about his research into the properties of the fungus Metarhizium, which can kill a wide variety of insects. Scott received a student award from the Society of Invertebrate Pathology in August. We all feel stress in our lives, and on a day-to-day basis, it can be a motivator of sorts, but too much stress, like too much of anything else, is not so good. Student stress is a serious issue in our educational institutions today, and measures need to be taken to deal with the problem head-on before it becomes a much more serious issue. Chloe Hamza is a doctoral student in the Department of Psychology in the Lifespan Development Stream at Brock University. She's completed her undergraduate degree in psychology at King's University College at Western. Chloe's interest in an academic career first emerged during her work as a CAMH research assistant, and because of that experience, she found her passion for psychology. Hamza has conducted a study collecting data from more than 1,000 university students to study the link between non-suicidal self-injury, or NSSI, and suicidal behavior. Her work was recently profiled in the Student Spotlight section of the Evidence Exchange Network for Mental Health and Addictions. Chloe is a 2010 Vanier Scholar and received a 2013 Ontario Graduate Scholarship. Her supervisor is Professor Tina Willoughby. Chloe joined us in the studio this week to talk about her research into NSSI.
So NSSI actually refers to non-suicidal self-injury. And non-suicidal self-injury is actually a more common problem than I think most people think. It's estimated that as many as 20 to 38% of young adults report lifetime histories of NSSI. And this would include behaviors such as self-cutting, burning, hitting, headbanging that are performed without lethal intent. So they differ from suicidal behavior in that the intent of the individual is not to end their own life, but to obviously directly harm themselves using these types of behavior.
The obvious question is, if there's not an intent to really harm themselves, you ask why? Why do they do it?
So there are a variety of reasons that people engage in NSSI, but the most common reason that we've sort of identified in the research is regulating one's emotions. So a lot of research has shown that NSSI is a good way for people, or an effective way for people, to reduce stress, to reduce anxiety. So typically when people are experiencing these negative emotions, or they're feeling stressed or overwhelmed, they may choose to engage in NSSI, similar to other coping behaviors like smoking or drinking, to reduce those sort of negative emotions.
Now, what kind of numbers are we looking at?
So in our own research at Brock, we found that as many as 38% of young adults have engaged in NSSI at some point in time, and about 50% of those with a history of NSSI are still engaging in NSSI during the university years. So there's actually quite a large proportion of individuals who have at some point at least experimented with this type of behavior. Again, similar to the way students might experiment with other types of problem behavior like binge drinking or cigarette smoking.
The numbers are startling, though. Is peer pressure Does that have anything to do with this at all?
I think part of the reason that people are surprised by the numbers is that not a lot of people actually disclose their NSSI behaviors. So there's still a lot of stigma surrounding NSSI. People have negative reactions when they hear that someone self-injures. So self-injurers aren't particularly, I think, motivated to disclose these behaviors to other people. They kind of keep them to themselves. And unfortunately, when individuals don't disclose this behavior, that also sort of acts as a barrier to help seeking. So if you don't tell anyone that you're self-injuring, you're less likely to go seek help or to access resources that are available to you. Typically, NSSI occurs alone. So most people do not engage in self-injury with other people. So I would say that for the most part, peer pressure isn't sort of the driving force with NSSI as it might be, let's say, for drinking or binge drinking at bars or going out with friends. Whereas self-injury typically occurs when someone is by themselves in the context of these sort of negative emotions, when they kind of want to regulate these internal behavior. In our large sample of over 1,000 students, only 50% of the people who had engaged in non-suicidal self-injury had told anyone. And so this is early adulthood. These individuals have never shared these types of behavior or the fact that they engage in NSSI with another person, anyone, parents, teachers, friends. And in fact, the first time they may have ever even indicated that they engage in this behavior could be on our survey. So I think that shows that most people do not feel comfortable engaging or sharing with other people that they engage in NSSI. And I think the reason for that is because people do tend to have really negative reactions to these types of disclosure. So there's a lot of stigma surrounding NSSI. I don't think people understand why individuals engage in NSSI. And therefore, self-injurers often feel misunderstood. They think that people won't respond well to these reactions, so they have to hide this behavior. And there's been a lot of research to suggest that secret keeping, not being able to disclose a behavior that you're struggling with, can actually have sort of negative effects on an individual. So ideally, people would be able to share or to confide in someone that they're engaging in this behavior, which could be sort of the first step to seeking help in a more professional way.
You touched on the family. I could see this being something you would want to keep from the family. Did the family come into your study at all in terms of when they're disclosing to you what they're doing? Is there a part of the study that examines how much they've disclosed to their family?
Absolutely.
Because I would think the family would be totally surprised and taken off guard by this.
Mm-hmm. We do ask specifically among those individuals who have disclosed to someone, who did they disclose to? And typically the most commonly reported source of disclosure is a friend. So typically people do disclose to their peers more so than anyone else. But we do find that there's sort of another group who have disclosed to, let's say, a mother or a father, but not as frequently as they would for peers. There's also been some research to suggest that parents tend to underestimate the frequency with which an individual engages in NSSI. So parents don't always know that their child is engaging in this behavior, or if they do know, they tend to underestimate the extent to which they're engaging in this behavior, which again highlights the fact that self-injurers really do seem to keep this behavior to themselves. They don't tell their parents, they don't share, for the most part.
Denial, I would think, would come into play here as well, especially as far as the family is concerned.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I think parents want to think that their children are doing well. They want to be there for their child as well. But some parents just have no idea because, again, self-injury is more common than most people think. And it happens among all types of people. It's not specific to a particular group. So lots of students who are doing well in school, who are high functioning, may nevertheless have at some point in time experimented with this behavior. So I don't know that parents are aware or know the extent to which this behavior occurs.
Now, would there be other signs of NSSI before they get to university? Would the mechanism already be there, or does it develop once they reach university?
So a lot of research has suggested that adolescence tends to be the period when NSSI begins. The most sort of commonly reported first age of onset for NSSI is usually between the ages of 13 to 15. So it's occurring in sort of early to middle adolescence. Having said that, research suggests that as many many as 40% of individuals who engage in NSSI first start between the ages of 17 and 24. So there's another group who do seem to start in sort of early adulthood or late adolescence, potentially as they're transitioning from high school into university or early adulthood.
Does the NSSI symptom come as basically as an outgrowth of the stress that they're experiencing at university? Or does it go deeper than that? In other words, it's a symptom of a bigger problem.
That's a good question, and there's no clear answer. I mean, we found in our research fairly consistently that NSSI is used as a way to regulate these negative emotions, so to reduce stress, to reduce anxiety. So there's certainly some research to suggest that transitional periods, such as entering into adolescence or early adulthood, starting university, could be a stressful time for students. They have to navigate, particularly with university, they have to navigate new demands. So a heavy course load, potentially leaving home for the first time, living in residence, meeting new people, managing their finances. So any of these factors can be stressful or difficult. And certainly some individuals may have difficulty adjusting to these new challenges. So potentially self-injury is one coping behavior that people turn to when they are feeling sort of overwhelmed or distressed.
So how close are they generally to reaching the state where suicide is seen as a viable option to cope with their stress once they reach the non-suicidal self-injury level that you were studying?
Non-suicidal self-injury definitely differs from suicidal behavior in the sense that non-suicidal self-injury, again, does not include lethal intent. So the individual's intent is not to end their own life. And typically, non-suicidal self-injury occurs more frequently than with, let's say, suicidal behavior, so something like a suicidal attempt. The majority of individuals who engage in non-suicidal self-injury are not suicidal and will never make a suicidal attempt. So it is estimated that as many as 90% of individuals with a history of non-suicidal self-injury, particularly in community-based samples, so lesson samples, university samples, 90% will never engage in suicidal behavior. So there is that distinct difference between these two types of behavior. Having said that, research has also shown that individuals who engage in non-suicidal self-injury are at increased risk for suicidal behavior. So although it's only 10% of those engaging in non-suicidal self-injury, these individuals are definitely at higher risk for suicidal behavior than individuals with no history of non-suicidal self-injury. So I would say that non-suicidal self-injury is like a risk factor for suicidal behavior, similar to the way, you know, depression might be a risk factor for suicidal behavior. But certainly not everyone who is depressed engages in suicidal behavior. And that's the same with NSSI. So there are many self-injurers who do not intend or never will intend to take their own life with suicidal behavior.
It basically becomes a coping mechanism for them and nothing more.
Exactly. So it's a coping behavior used to regulate distress. We do seem to see that this behavior occurs, there's sort of a developmental sort of timeline. You know, it emerges in adolescence. We see, again, a little bit of an increase in early adulthood. But from our own research, we can tell that it also seems to be tapering off a bit into later adulthood. So as people are finishing university or leaving university, which seems to suggest it may be a period that's sort of experimented with or used more commonly in sort of adolescence and emergent adulthood, like, you know, binge drinking, smoking, but then it sort of decreases over time.
In the news, when we hear about someone lashing out in a violent fashion, often people will say there were no signs beforehand. They had no inkling this was going to happen. But often there are signs there. We just don't pick up on them. What would be the warning signs here with NSSI?
It's very difficult because people are very good at hiding their NSSI. So obviously a key indicator would be if you see any, you know, scratching or scarring on the individual. But a lot of self-injurers hide these behaviors. So they self-injure somewhere that no one's going to see, and they cover these injuries. So it's very difficult to identify a sort of a key risk factor. If I had to say something, obviously individuals who are experiencing high levels of distress, so individuals who are feeling anxious, stressed, who are really struggling, might be at risk for trying to find some sort of maladaptive coping behavior. But again, self-injury can occur in a variety of individuals, so there's no clear picture of, you know, what a self-injurer looks like. Self-injury is common among a variety of people.
Not just students at university.
Right, definitely not just students, definitely high school students. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of work done with adults outside of university. I think non-suicidal self-injury is still a fairly new field of study, so there's a lot more work that needs to be done. But certainly, we would suggest that it occurs in adults as well as students or individuals who've finished school or who pursued career opportunities after high school. I think there's no reason to think that it wouldn't exist in these populations as well.
The students you studied were all at Brock University. Would these numbers be reflective of other universities in the country?
Absolutely. So the prevalence that we found, sort of 20 to 38%, is very consistent with other estimates from other universities in Canada as well as the States. Researchers have fairly consistently found that NSSI is quite prevalent, particularly among university students. And if you include a variety of behaviors, so if you ask individuals if they engage in self-cutting, burning, headbanging, self-hitting, we do tend to see these high estimates. Some researchers have just asked about self-cutting. Typically, then you might see lower prevalence rates. So if you include a broad spectrum of potential behaviors that could be classified as NSSI, I think the estimates are fairly consistent, you know, 20 to 38%. Whereas if you ask about specific behaviors, you know, just self-cutting, just self-hitting, you may find slightly lower prevalences. We've also found that it's better to include these sort of broad spectrum of behaviors because men and women may differ in the types of self-injury they use. So women typically tend to use self-cutting more, whereas men are more likely to report the self-hitting or self-burning. So if you only ask about self-cutting, you lose out on some of the male self-injurers potentially. So we found it's better off to include a variety of behaviors so we get at self-injury as it may occur in both males and females.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought the procedure would be gender biased, if you will.
Yeah, a lot of research, when research started on NSSI, reported that women reported higher rates of non-suicidal self-injury, and that was fairly consistent. But as ways to measure non-suicidal self-injury developed, scales developed, which included different types of behaviors, we really started to see that men and women had different types of behaviors that they typically engaged in. Now, that's not to say that women don't self-hit or burn, or that men don't self-cut. But on average, we did see these gender differences in the types of behaviors that men and women used. Now researchers acknowledge that it's fairly consistent, the prevalence of NSSI, across both males and females. There just might be, you know, slight differences in the types of behavior males and females engage in.
Now, how did you go about the study and collecting the data? Because I was reading about the period of time you did this in four waves. How were you doing that, and why did you stretch it out over that period of time?
So we started our project, Stressed at Brock, 4 years ago now. So we started surveying students in first-year university at Brock, and we had over 1,000 students who participated in our study. So essentially, you know, we went to residences, we invited students to come to the lab, and students would complete a survey, which included a variety of questions with a sort of overarching theme of looking at stress and coping among university students. And we decided that it was very important to follow these students over time because across the university years, things change. So living situations change, majors change, people's level of psychosocial distress, how they're feeling, how they're doing, these things change over time. So to understand, for example, non-suicidal self-injury among university students, we really needed to look at non-suicidal self-injury across the university years. So what happened in first year? What happened in second year? What happens beyond university? Because we need to look at, you know, the timeline. So does NSSI begin, stop, stay the same? Are there a select group of individuals who are consistently engaging in NSSI over time? Are there factors associated with stopping the behavior? And might this give us some indications about what we need to target? How do we prevent people from starting? So the overtime component was really critical to addressing some of our sort of central research questions about non-suicidal self-injury.
You talked about getting the people involved in taking the survey. That must have been somewhat difficult, I guess, because of the subject matter that you're dealing with. It would be difficult to address, but also for a student to admit that it would be a problem for them and they're willing to come out, if you will, and discuss it openly with you.
Absolutely. So part of our project, you know, the Stressed at Brock project, was to design the study or the survey that included a variety of questionnaires. So we asked students about several aspects of their university experience. So we look at stress, coping, adjustment to university life, social connectedness. So how are they feeling about their peer relationships, relationship with their family? How are they doing in school? And then we also include questions about self-injury and suicide. So several students completed the survey, not necessarily knowing that it was specific to self-injury and suicide, because it wasn't. That was an area of research that I was interested in, but there are several researchers involved in the study who are interested in a variety of aspects of the university experience. So I think we actually have a really good representative sample because we surveyed over 1,000 students at Brock. And again, we surveyed many students in residences, in the lab. We were open to inviting everyone who would fill out the survey. And so we definitely had some people who self-injured, some people who didn't, individuals with various backgrounds, various forms of coping behavior, some people who were doing really well, some people who were struggling with the transition to university.
Is it possible for you to adjust when you leave university? Because if you're having trouble dealing with stress within the university community, when you leave, you're faced with a whole new set of stresses in your life. Is there a way to better cope with the stress in your life so that you grow, for want of a better expression, you grow out of the need to use that as a mechanism to cope with the stress that you're facing?
So certainly there are ways for individuals who have been struggling to work on or improve their coping techniques or strategies, which is why we do, every year when we do the survey, we provide students with a list of local resources. So, you know, mental health resources within the community, not just at Brock, but beyond Brock, in the hopes that anyone who is having some difficulties potentially with the transition to university or even after university will access these resources. And in the context of the sort of help-seeking behavior, could be given sort of more effective ways to regulate stress, you know, learn some new emotion regulation techniques. So certainly we encourage that. We do try to equip students with resources. And you know, not a lot is known yet about non-suicidal self-injury among people who leave university. So that's something we're hoping to continue to do and continue to follow these students down the road after they leave and see how they're doing, what's changed in their life. You know, this might also be a very stressful period, trying to find employment, starting a serious relationship, or, you know, buying a home. So these are some things we will definitely be looking at in the future.
So beyond your study and the university life, what can society as a whole do to help these people cope and not utilize NSSI in order to cope with the stress that they're facing? What can we do to help them?
I think the biggest thing that I would encourage society as a whole to do is work on the stigma surrounding NSSI. So if an individual discloses to someone, to you, that they're self-injuring, you know, respond with compassion and warmth. Listen to the individual. Be there for them. Provide support. A friendly ear, I think, is very important. If you respond negatively, this person's not likely to tell anyone else that they self-injure. And a lot of research suggests that disclosing in and of itself can be helpful to someone. So just getting off your chest that you're engaging in self-injury or that you're struggling with self-injury may in and of itself be helpful, provided you have a good response from the person you're disclosing to. As a community, you know, keeping or making sure that resources are available to students. So having access to a variety of resources that are obviously not a financial burden to students. So free, accessible mental health services is important. They've recently just started sort of the development of the 24-hour helpline for students. So I think things like that are awesome, are a really great way to provide support to students or individuals who are engaging in NSSI. And again, on a community level, I would say, you know, really be aware of your own perceptions about NSSI. Treat an NSSI disclosure the way you would treat a disclosure about parental separation or, you know, difficulties with alcohol use. So be warm, be compassionate, and give support to these individuals.
We're talking with Chloe Hamza, a doctoral student in the Department of Psychology at Brock University. Just talking about you, I'm curious, why was psychology your life calling when you got to university?
Well, when I started university, I actually did my undergrad at King's University College at the University of Western Ontario. And I was taking sort of a more general liberal arts degree at the time. And I fell in love with my psychology. The first time I took psychology, my first year psychology course, I just fell in love with the course content. I found it really interesting. I thought the study of human behavior was fascinating. And then I decided I wanted to specialize in psychology, so I took a variety of courses and did a lot of volunteering with different research organizations to get a sense of what research I was most sort of passionate or interested in. And through those experiences, I determined I really was interested in sort of developmental psychology, so how human behavior develops over time, what predicts the development of various behaviors over time. I really enjoyed survey design, so survey research. And then, of course, I discovered the area that I was most interested in was sort of mental health, which is why I chose Brock, because my advisor was doing research on sort of stress and coping among university students. And so that really motivated me to pursue graduate work.
So where do you see yourself going once your university days are done?
So my hope is ultimately to become an independent researcher. So I would like to essentially become a professor at a university and continue to do my research on sort of mental health and coping. Hopefully I will also have some involvement or continue to have some involvement with more community-based agencies that are also doing research or working directly with individuals with self-injury so that my research can continue to inform sort of best practice. So yeah, that would be the goal.
Chloe, thank you very much for coming in today. This is amazing information that we've gleaned from your study, and I appreciate you coming in and telling us about it, and best of luck with the work in the future.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was psychology doctoral student Chloe Hamza on her research studying the link between non-suicidal self-injury and suicidal behavior using data from more than 1,000 university students. We've heard and seen a lot over the last year or so about the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812, a battle that raged on for 2 years, spanning both sides of the Niagara River. The celebration of 200 years of peaceful coexistence since then will continue unabated until the end of 2014, of course, throughout Niagara. While much of the attention involves such locales as Queenston, Niagara-on-the-Lake, Niagara Falls, and of course Thorold, there is a St. Catharines connection as well. That local connection is the impetus for a new War of 1812 exhibit that opened at the St. Catharines Museum and Welland Canal Center last month and will remain open to the public until the end of 2014. War of 1812 is a collaborative effort developed over the past year by the City of St. Catharines and Brock University with financial support in the form of a grant from the Government of Canada's Bicentennial of the War of 1812 program. David Sharon is the head of Special Collections and Archives at Brock, and he joined us in the CFPU studios recently to talk about the new exhibit.
It's about 1,500 square feet, and it takes up a largely unused space in the museum. It's on the second level, and it's a great way to use the vacant space.
What would have been provided by the Special Collections and Archives at Brock for the exhibit?
We provided a lot of the artifacts and archival material that's on display, the imagery, and we did a lot of the research in conjunction with the people at the museum.
I would imagine this would be a fairly interactive display. You couldn't do a museum display in this day and age without making it much more interactive than it would have been in the past.
It's a hard thing to go interactive and non-interactive when you're talking about artifacts and materials that are 200 years old. So what we are very fortunate with is our exhibit designer also provided us with 4 computer kiosks, which are touchscreen, and that makes the interactions much more viable and much more modern for the modern day museum goer. So it's really cool, some of the effects that they have in there. They have games, we have a trivia quiz, we have maps of the War of 1812 overlaid with modern day Google Maps. So it's really quite neat, the digital side of the exhibit.
So what kind of artifacts and related materials would we be seeing in the exhibit?
We follow a timeline from just before the war all the way through 1815. And what you'll see on display are actual letters, documents, and material culture from the 1812 era. So we have an oath of allegiance that a bunch of local gentlemen from the town of Chippewa, Niagara Falls, signed at the outbreak of the war. We have a lot of War of 1812 era newspapers talking about the battles that happened here in Niagara. And on the artifact side, we have a musket, a small little revolver. We have chinaware from the time period, cannonballs, little musket balls. It's quite diverse. The materials that we have came from our collection, the museum's collection. We had a local person loan out materials from his personal collection to go on display, as well as Parks Canada loaned us a lot of materials to put out. So it's a nice diverse collection of materials, and you get a sense of a little bit of everything when you go through it.
It's only been open for a little while, and it will be open till the end of 2014. Any early indication what the response is from the public? Have you heard anything at all?
The motif really went over well. The exhibit designer did a great thing. They went out to Fort George just to get a sense of what the War of 1812 with a fort would have looked like at the time. And they reproduced the look and feel of a fort, and then they embedded the cases within there. So when you walk in, you see this kind of rustic old wooden fort with the materials right there. So it looks impressive when you first walk in. And we did a lot of research on it. So from what we've heard from the other historians who are very, very keen on the War of 1812, they've said we've done a very good job. So we're happy with that.
Now, some might be surprised St. Catharines was connected much at all to the War of 1812, other than simply watching from the sidelines. What would be the connection?
That is probably the biggest amount of research that came out of this. We had 2 Brock students do the initial research, and they scoured the materials at Brock. They went online and found other information. But what they really looked at were war loss claims, and they really focused on what happened in St. Catharines. And when you look at what people claim the damages were to their everyday property during the War of 1812, St. Catharines was affected almost as heavily as any other place in Niagara. Troops from both sides were tramping through Grantham Township and what would have been considered St. Catharines all the time. They would take down their fence posts and burn it for fire. They'd take food, livestock. They would use their houses as barracks if necessary. Churches were turned into hospitals. Barns were hospitals. And the people had to put up with it because there was no other options. So St. Catharines was not on the sidelines at all. Skirmishes happened. There was just no major pitched battle that you can see recorded in the history books. But everyday life was a big upheaval for the people of St. Catharines. And I think that's the one thing that we pulled out of this that I think is very new in terms of research. And it's something that we wanted to put on display.
Yeah. In other words, they weren't on the front lines, but you could not avoid what was going on just down the road.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, speaking of down the road, today you think Niagara Falls, Niagara-on-the-Lake, Queenston, those areas, less than half an hour's drive away. Not a big deal. But in those days, that would have been considerable distance to travel from St. Catharines, as Laura Secord proved on her famous walk. So, in a way, from the actual fire, other than those skirmishes that you referred to, would they have felt a little more protected from the action here?
I think front lines, definitely. They were far removed from the fort and where the major battles would have been. I guess Beaver Dams and the burning of St. David would probably be the 2 closest events that would have happened to St. Catharines or the people of Grantham. But yeah, I think the constant threat was there. more so the marauding side of things, like people walking across your property and you don't know what they're going to do, and they're well-armed, probably very hungry and very, don't know what word you would say for someone who's been in battle all day, but I don't think they'd be happy people. So it was very stressful time for the people of this area, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. If people come wandering around, our natural inclination now would be to offer help.
Yeah.
Then the natural inclination would be to be prepared to defend yourself, because you don't know just what's happening out there, and especially if it's dark at night.
And if your husband's away in the militia, some other town, city, or place in Ontario or United States, it was just the women and children at home taking care of the farms, and that's a scary prospect as well back in those days.
We had a lot of local figures who figured prominently in the battles from St. Catharines. William Hamilton Merritt would be a good example. Tell us about that aspect of it, the local connection when it comes to the leadership in the battle.
The good thing about William Hamilton Merritt is he wrote down a lot of his memories of the War of 1812, often with quite the embellishment that you would expect from a man of his nature. But he did record the feelings of how he felt leaving his family and leaving his sister and his mother behind, and talking about people packing up all their things and moving even further inland just to be more safe than being on the main road along the Lake Ontario. So you get a better sense of how people felt during the war through Merritt's papers. And of course, he was a leader, and he was at a lot of the major events that happened locally, and then he was taken prisoner for the second half of the war. So he lived a very, I guess, unique experience. He was in the successes of the war, as well as being captured and being on enemy lines for the longest time, and he was courting his future wife at the same time while he was in prison. And first thing he did when he got out is snatched her up and brought her back to St. Catharines. So that sounded very caveman-like, but it wasn't quite like that, because he was desperate to get back with her when he was in prisons. But it was very enlightening to read his materials. And then we have people like Richard Pierpoint, who initiated the Color Corps using former slaves or African-American residents who were living in the area to be a unit of their own with the local militia. So he was settled here in the Grantham Louth area, and he did great things, and the Color Corps was an important part of a lot of the local battles. So yeah, we did have some local people who did some great things.
All's fair in love and war, as far as William Hamilton Merritt is concerned.
Absolutely.
I can understand how, if he's in prison, he'd long for the love of his life. I think that's a natural inclination. But you think during the war, yeah, that would help you to get through what you're going through with the war.
Absolutely. He was fortunate enough that he could still correspond while he was in prison. He was a gentleman and got some privileges that maybe the common soldier wouldn't get while in prison. But yeah, he was still able to correspond and keep that link alive.
We're talking with David Sharon, head of the Special Collections and Archives at Brock, about the War of 1812 exhibit that opened earlier this month at the St. Catharines Museum. Beyond the local level, the war allowed us nationally as well as locally to sort of come of age. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It gave us something to rally around. At the time, a lot of the people who settled in this area were former Americans, and the business ties were very well linked to America. And that's why the Americans thought it would be a matter of marching across the border and taking over Canada. But it was really a wonderful thing that the inhabitants of Upper Canada saw themselves as British subjects and wanted to be their own nation, or young nation at the time. And so they came together and defended themselves. And that became a rallying point years and years later. We wouldn't be celebrating it 200 years later if it wasn't something we've been proud of for the last 200 years. Hundreds of books have been written about the war. It does stand the test of time that this was a big point in Canadian history.
Now, speaking of the celebrations, this may be a little unfair for me to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There's been so much hype generated about the 200th anniversary in general. Is it a bit much, or should we be taking the opposite approach? It's about time we celebrated our local history, and this is a wonderful opportunity to do so.
I think the opportunity's there. How often do you get to celebrate 200 years of anything? And something like the War of 1812, which was had a big effect locally, nationally, provincially, it's something we should celebrate. We should be proud of what the people in the past have done, and that started the communities that we live in today, yeah, it absolutely should be a celebrated part of our life. And looking forward to what's next on our anniversary list, World War One. That's going to be happening next year, 100th anniversary of that, and that should be celebrated just as much. Brave men and women did amazing things, and we live in a time where we don't worry so much about those types of conflicts, but they did, and what they had to put up with was shocking and amazing that they pulled through and became stronger for it. So it is worth celebrating.
Walking through the exhibit and interacting with it, what do you think we can learn in this day and age from what is on display and the stories that are being told about the War of 1812?
I think you can really see that it wasn't just a small conflict here and there. It was big. You can see from the newspapers, they were pulling information from everywhere, and it would be sometimes you can see a report on the Battle of Queenston. The first news reports took 1 or 2 weeks to get out on the newspapers because they would only print once a week often. And then you'll see down the road, the further cities are still reporting on the Battle of Queenston 4 weeks later. And then 6 to 8 weeks later, the news is just starting to hit London. And so it is really interesting to see how the news traveled and what information the people were getting at certain times. And the military had to use that type of information and that kind of timing to plan their next attacks. So based on information that they're getting 2 weeks late, they have to figure out what they're going to do next when 100 other things could have happened in between. So you can really get a sense of how difficult it was to manage the field and be a military leader at the time, like Isaac Brock, and make the decisions they did based on the limited information at hand. They didn't have cell phones, walkie-talkies, or telephones. They had to rely on a person on the horse delivering a letter or what they're reading in the official reports. And other things you can learn is the local history. We do have a lot of local information in the exhibit that would enlighten you, like I said earlier, with how St. Catharines was a big part of the war. I think the biggest takeaway from this exhibit is St. Catharines deserves a little more recognition than they've ever gotten.
Now, the exhibit is continuing until the end of 2014. At that point, I presume everything, the artifacts and what have you, will return to their original homes, and what you loaned out will come back.
Yes, yes. Okay. It'll be back in the collection. The really great thing about what Brock has loaned out to the museum for the next year and a half, we digitized all these materials, and so people can still see it if they need to use it for research or study or anything like that. It is available online, so it's not completely unavailable.
Now, would this be considered one of the more interesting exhibits that you've had the opportunity to work on?
This was great. I haven't done an exhibit design at this level for at least 4 years, and it was great to get back into it. I love doing the research, and the hard thing is not overloading the exhibit with too much information. It's hard because you have these little gems that you come up with, and you try to force it into the exhibit, but then you realize you're forcing it. You have to just tell the story according to the script that you kind of laid out, and it was fun. It was a really fun experience. It was challenging, but every day you got to dig in, do something a little bit different, even helping set up the exhibits, placing where it's going to go, where the lighting is going to go. It was a very creative process, and it was a more enjoyable part of it.
Have you taken your kids to see it yet?
Not yet. It was just a busy weekend. So we're going to be coming very soon.
Thank you very much, David, for coming in today.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
And that was David Sharon, head of Special Collections and Archives at Brock, talking about the new exhibit at the St. Catharines Museum and Welland Canal Center on the city's involvement in the War of 1812 effort. Don't feel badly, David. I haven't made it down yet to see the exhibit either, but I will soon. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions.